My name is Dan Mornoff. I'm the president of the local chapter of the Federalist Society. I want to thank you all for coming for what I think is going to be a pretty great event. We do appreciate that you're here. Let me mention right up front that for those of you who are lawyers, if you sign in at the sign-in sheets at the door, we will make sure that you get CLE credit for this. So please do let us know that. There are very few people who can claim that they have served as judges, executives, and legislators. We are lucky today to be joined by someone who can say that he's done all of those things. Senator John Cornyn served as a district court judge, as a member of the Supreme Court of Texas, as our attorney general, and of course is currently, a senator. I can actually only think of one other person who's had all of those roles, and I'm happy to report that Senator Cornyn has done a better job in each of these roles than Abner Mikva did in any. With that said, he is now a leading voice on the Judiciary Committee, where he was a prominent supporter of a number of nominees who stood for the kind of understanding of judicial restraint and its appropriateness that this institution certainly appreciates, including, of course, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. He played a huge role in opposing the filibusters of questionable constitutionality of President Bush's judicial nominees, including Priscilla Owens. More recently, he's emerged as a leading opponent of judicial activists nominated to the bench and the use of foreign jurisprudence or norms of international law as sources of valid law in American constitutional development. We're really proud to have him here. I hope that you'll join me in giving a warm welcome to our soon-to-be senior senator, John Cornyn.
Well, thank you, Dan, and it's good to be here with all of you today. Thank you very much for the invitation. One of the great things I've always enjoyed about the Federalist Society is that members of the Federalist Society aren't afraid to have a good debate and to defend their position, whatever that position may be, based on the principles, based on the merits. And, you know, that seems kind of far-fetched sometimes in the debates we have in Washington, D.C., where spin doctors and spin control seems to count for more than the merits of a particular position or debate. But I want to just say, in addition to being glad to be here with all of you, I'm really glad to see a couple of folks who used to work with me, Judge Reed O'Connor and his wife Tammy are here. It's great to see you. And Chip Roy, who's now Assistant U.S. Attorney. And, you know, I'm folks in my position depend on really top quality staff, and Reed and Chip did a great job for me when they were on the Judiciary Committee staff and helping me through all these battles. I always tell my staff their job is to make me look good, no matter how hard that is on any given occasion, but they really did a great work. But the Federalist Society, of course, has a proud tradition of starting in the early 80s, when many conservatives despaired over judicial activism occurring at the highest levels of our judiciary, particularly the United States Supreme Court. And we know law professors mostly tend to come from a left-leaning bent and write law reviews and come up with creative legal theories about how the written word does not mean what it says, or trying to justify some alternative interpretation that is not tethered to something you and I might call law, as opposed to a legal theory. So back in 1982, a group of law students began to fight back. They believed that the role of judiciary was to say what the law is, not what it should be. Doesn't seem like a far-fetched concept. And I guess the question for all of us, whether we're judges or legislators or practicing lawyers, is, to me, it boils down to this. It's not what's the right answer. It's who gets to answer the question. Is it a judiciary who takes on the role of a super legislative branch, or maybe philosopher-in-chief that tells us what's good for us, notwithstanding what the legislature or elected representatives have said? Or is it a more, to use Justice Roberts' terms, a more modest role? One that recognizes that the judiciary plays a very important part in our three branches of government, but one that is limited, one that exercises self-restraint to say what the law is, not what it should be, leaving to the elected representatives of the people the job to say what the law is, along with the time-honored right that every American citizen has to throw the rascals out if they don't do what we want them to do, which is the way I think it's supposed to work. Well, we've got some very big challenges, as you know, in Washington these days. President Obama has now nominated and seen confirmed three judicial nominees, and I expect that the pace is going to pick up here considerably. We spent a lot of time on Judge Sotomayor's nomination, and but it's really in a unique situation, at least for the 6.5 years I've been in the Senate, because right now the president obviously gets to make the nominations. The Democrats have a filibuster-proof Senate. I would say I was one of those who said that I thought the requirement of a 60-vote threshold for confirming judicial nominees to me conflicted with the constitutional requirement of a majority vote for judicial confirmations, and struck me as just unconstitutional to require a 60-vote threshold by Senate rules that was not contemplated in the Constitution when it came to the role of advice and consent. So even if Republicans had more numbers, even if we could block a nomination by a filibuster, I don't believe you would see a filibuster. I could be wrong. We'll see how things develop. But my position is it's not an appropriate standard. Well, I mentioned Judge Sotomayor and her confirmation of the Supreme Court. There's Judge Lynch, confirmed to the Second Circuit, and Judge Jeffrey Vitkin to the District Court for the District of South Dakota. It's really kind of strange that there have only been three in the 9 or 10 months now that the Obama administration has been in charge, but as I said, I expect the pace will pick up considerably. If President Obama serves two full terms in the as President of the United States, he could well replace half of the federal judiciary in 8 years. Even if he only serves one term, he very likely will nominate judges to serve two vacancies on the Supreme Court of the United States. So he will be in a position to have a big influence on the kinds of judges who serve in our federal judiciary. Of course, people looking to where the president's philosophy towards the judiciary comes from have to start, I think, with his actions as a United States senator himself. As a senator, he voted against Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito in their confirmation, two individuals, I believe, who are among the finest additions to the Supreme Court we've seen in a long time. My concern is also in what the president said about what his standard for a judicial nominee should be, when he said that judges should look beyond the law to the judge's personal values, core concerns, and empathy. Of course, we all recognize these as code words for some deciding cases based on something other than the written word and based on what the legislature intended and what the Constitution itself says. He also said that a critical ingredient to what judges should, any judge that he might confirm or as a senator or nominate as a president, is what's in the judge's heart. Well, I want to make a few observations about some of his judicial nominations that I think tend to reflect that his views he expressed as a senator about the standard for judicial nominees has been reflected in the nominees that he has proposed so far. And I'll start with Harold Coe. Harold Coe, as you know, is the former dean of Yale Law School. obviously a brilliant lawyer, and but now he's been confirmed as the legal advisor to the State Department. Of course, many people saw Professor Coe, Dean Coe, as likely on a pathway to the federal judiciary at some point, including the United States Supreme Court. But in the role he plays now as the legal advisor of the State Department, he, of course, is the one who gives the legal advice to the State Department with regard to the debacle in Honduras now about who is actually the president of that country. And, of course, the State Department has declined to release his legal advice while the debacle continues. But he has a very important role because, of course, he will provide advice to not only the State Department, but to the Department of Defense and other federal agencies that are very important. Well, to the point that I wanted to make about Dean Coe, he has said that federal judges should use cases and controversies before them to verdict what he says, quote, vertically enforce or domesticate American laws with international norms and foreign law. He's argued that federal judges should help, quote, build the bridge between the international and domestic law through interpretive techniques. And he said he believes in what he calls transnational jurisprudence. This philosophy, according to Evan Thomas and Stuart Taylor in Newsweek, they said could, quote, erode American democracy and sovereignty if taken to its logical extreme. In June of this year, 62 senators voted to confirm Harold Coe to the State Department. And then there's Don Johnson. Don Johnson has not been confirmed, thank goodness, to the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. This, of course, is a position of tremendous influence in the federal government. It's sometimes been called the president's law firm. This is the office that provides legal advice to not only the Department of Justice, but to the entire executive branch, and whose opinions are considered to be virtually the final word, absent a court ruling on the matters upon which they opine. Of course, there have been a distinguished lineage of people who have been chief of that office, including William Rehnquist, including Justice Scalia. And as we know from the recent, over the last 8 years or so, debate about things ranging from rendition to enhanced interrogation techniques and the like, this office is very important in determining the scope of authority of the Central Intelligence Agency or intelligence community at large, and of course, other federal agencies. Ms. Johnson is currently working as a law professor at Indiana University, and I think it's fair to say that she harbors what only can be described as radical views. On national security, she's taken a very narrow view of executive power and a very expansive view of the rights of terrorists. She said that she once celebrated the 4th of July by closely rereading Lawrence versus Texas, which she said represented her vision of America and where we should be heading. She's called originalism, as applied by Justice Scalia, a lie. She said it has the effect of freezing constitutional meaning at a time when only white propertied men were fully protected under the law. Well, Ms. Johnson's views are so radical that not even some of our friends on the other side of the aisle can vote to confirm her, and so she has not been confirmed by the Senate, and the threat of a bipartisan filibuster of her nomination has caused her to remain in the private sector at Indiana Law School, where I think she ought to stay for some time. And then, of course, there is Judge Sotomayor. Now, I have to tell you, Judge Sotomayor is a charming, charming person with an incredible life story, and someone that is easy to like and admire. Her career is the embodiment of the American dream, as we've heard over and over again. And she's had a lot of judicial experience as a district judge and as a member of the Court of Appeals. But based on a careful review of her decisions as a federal district court judge and a circuit court judge, I found most of them to be what I would consider to be within the mainstream. But of course, the role of a Supreme Court justice is much different from that of a lower court judge who knows that her decisions will be reviewed by a higher court. But in this case, it wasn't so much what the judge had decided as a judge, it was what she had said in various speeches and seminars that caused us to wonder, will the real Sonia Sotomayor please stand up? For example, she said there's no neutrality in the law. Other times she said that the role of judges is to make policy. You remember that YouTube video clip where then she said, well, she realized she was on film and began to backtrack immediately to sort of knowing laughter in the crowd. She said that foreign law can help judges get their creative juices flowing as they interpret the U.S. Constitution. And she said that a judge's ethnicity and gender should influence the judge's decision, and that judges with a particular background actually make better decisions. And you'll remember the quote I'm thinking about. And so, in the end, I did not feel like I knew what we were getting in the Judge Sotomayor in her case, and I could not support her nomination. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that hearing and other things that I think sort of gave us foreshadowing of what future Supreme Court confirmation hearings will be like. So in a short time, we've seen some nominees, some confirmed, some not, that I think tend to show the Obama administration's clear determination to advance what I think is a philosophy of activism, and in the case of judges, judicial activism. But, you know, it's the most remarkable thing about it, and this is particularly so in the Sotomayor confirmation hearing, is that she refused to embrace, indeed she seemed to repudiate, some of her more radical statements that I quoted that she made in various speeches and seminars and in her other written materials. And we've seen a refusal to try to defend a philosophy that might support judicial activism on the merits. Now, I found it very surprising, and I must say it's also, I found it encouraging to hear that the proponents of judges who had might otherwise embrace judicial activism, that philosophy, refusing to defend it, but indeed they use the words of those of us who believe in judicial restraint to get through the confirmation hearing. I had expected with 60 votes in the U.S. Senate and with a president who shared the philosophy of judicial activists that they might make a public case for it at Supreme Court confirmation hearings. They might have claimed a mandate, perhaps, for the kind of judge that candidate Obama said he would want if he were confirmed. And they might have used the confirmation hearings to make a case to the American people that the philosophy of judicial restraint is wrong and that theirs is right. But I think very noticeably, they refused to do that. Instead, they did two interesting things. First, they pretended to be champions of judicial restraint. Judge Sotomayor, you may have heard, she said, we asked what is her judicial philosophy, she said fidelity to the law. She said that judges should rely upon the original intent of the framers in interpreting the Constitution. She said the intent of the founders was set forth in the Constitution. It's their words that are the most important aspect of judging. You follow what they say in their words and you apply it to the facts you're looking at. Pretty unremarkable to those of us who believe in judicial restraint. Very remarkable coming from somebody who said there's no such thing as neutrality in the law. Actually, what she said at their confirmation hearing sounds like something we'd hear at a Federalist Society meeting like this, right? On the issue of foreign law, notwithstanding her previous statements that said that judges should consult foreign law to get their creative juices flowing when interpreting the U.S. Constitution, at her hearing she said foreign law cannot be used as a holding or a precedent or to bind or influence the Constitution, influence the outcome of a legal decision in interpreting the Constitution or American law. And when asked about President Obama's stated belief that what's in a person's heart should influence the outcome in a case. She said, I wouldn't approach the issue of judging the way the president does. Judges can't rely on what's in their heart. The job of a judge is to apply the law. Good for her. But think about what that quote actually did. Here, a judicial nominee, now a current justice on the United States Supreme Court, has publicly repudiated the standard expressed by the president who nominated her. And no one on the president's side of the aisle stood up to defend his position, and few people outside the committee room even noticed. So, what are some conclusions we could draw? I would say the first conclusion is that judicial activists are scared to defend their philosophy in public and have embraced the rhetoric of judicial restraint. And secondly, we have seen, and this is another, I think, very important development, is that the left has tried to attack advocates of judicial restraint, most notably Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts, as judicial activists. For example, Al Franken has said the Roberts Court, specifically and most egregiously, Clarence Thomas, has been very activist. Thus spoke Al Franken. I'm not sure what qualifies him to make that judgment, but he's a United States Senator, and he's certainly entitled to express his opinion. Senator Feinstein from California defined judicial activism to mean that any time a court overrules an earlier precedent, she basically said that's judicial activism. And Senator Chuck Schumer said this 2 years ago. He said, in case after case, our most recently confirmed justices has appeared to jettison decisions recently authored by their immediate predecessors. The decisions this term were especially cruel, he said, advancing the traditional conservative preference for the government over criminal defendants and the interests of business over consumers and employees. I believe these allegations are demonstrably false. We all understand what judicial activism really is. Judicial activism is the substitution of a judge's policy preferences for those of the elected representatives of the people, or the document that we have ratified as states when we joined the Union, the U.S. Constitution. Judicial activism emphatically does not mean reversing previous decisions which were themselves a product of judicial activism, or striking down laws that limit the fundamental liberties enshrined in our Constitution. Judicial activism at its core represents a repudiation of the separation of powers doctrine embodied in our Constitution. John Adams wrote it as fundamental that judges shall never exercise the legislative or executive power, or either one of them, so that our laws can be a government of laws and not of men. Judicial activists reject the view expressed by Chief Justice Roberts at his confirmation hearing when he memorably used the analogy, which seems to drive the left absolutely batty, of a baseball umpire calling balls and strikes. Instead, they would say that a baseball umpire's personal sympathies or wishes for an outcome in a contest would be decided by just that and not by the rules of the game. So judicial activism is not a difficult concept to understand. We've seen many examples of it over time. For example, we've seen judicial activism in cases involving the war on terror, in which judges have invented rights for enemy combatants never before recognized by any court in this country, and in fact overruling earlier decisions dating back to World War II. We've seen judicial activism in cases relating to the death penalty, where the Supreme Court struck down laws enacted by many states for heinous crimes committed by those under the age of 18, invoking foreign law in the process. And we've seen judicial activism in places like California, and indeed right here in Dallas, Texas, where judges have impose their own views with regard to same-sex marriage and what who can legally be married, or I guess in this case, who needs to be divorced in a court of law, I think is another example of making it up as you go along. The American people understand what judicial activism means, and they don't like it very much at all. 63% of American people have said, I mean, I wish it were 100%, but 63% said in a recent poll that judges should make the rulings based on what in the law, and the, including the Constitution. Well, so many Americans disapprove of judicial activism, yet the left continues to try to advance false charges of judicial activism among those who are doing their best, I believe, to exercise the role of the judge modestly and with the kind of self-restraint that respects the separation of powers and the right of the American people to determine their destiny, not the right of unelected, lifetime tenured judges to tell us what's good for us. Well, I want to just close by just saying a couple words about the great judges and prosecutors we have who are part of our federal judiciary and our legal system. And close on this on a very important issue, at least to me, about what kind of people should be confirmed, not only as district judges, circuit court judges, Supreme Court judges, but also as United States attorneys. Now, some of you may have seen that Senator Hutchison and I have a bipartisan group of lawyers, some of the most outstanding legal professionals in the state, to screen our judicial nominees, or U.S. Marshal nominees, or I should say the President's nominees, as well as the U.S. attorneys. And many of us, many of you know that Senator Hutchison and I have worked very closely with the White House to try to make sure that this process is fair, that it's inclusive, that anyone and everyone who wants to apply can find a pipeline into making sure that their credentials are reviewed and that anyone who is selected be selected because they indeed are among the best and brightest, not because of politics. Well, in the case of the U.S. attorney here in Dallas County, you may have seen that Senator Hutchison and I have sent the name of Sarah Saldana to the President and said that if he saw fit to nominate her, then we would certainly work to see that she would be confirmed. It's, as you know, Ms. Saldana is chief of the Northern District's Fraud and Public Corruption Division. She's received overwhelming support from the legal community, and she very much impressed Senator Hutchison and myself in our face-to-face interviews. We know that the White House is also a fan of hers because originally they sent her name over to us as a potential nominee for pre-screening. But apparently her nomination is opposed by one or more members of the Texas House delegation. But I have yet to hear a single legitimate reason offered why Ms. Saldana would not be a good nominee and serve with honor and dignity as United States Attorney in Dallas in the Northern District of Texas. I'm concerned that the real reasons for this opposition are rooted more in politics than the merits. But for those, including some of our friends in the Texas congressional delegation, who believe that somehow the Senate should not be involved in the confirmation process, I would urge them to reread Article 2 of the Constitution and maybe acquaint themselves with the practices and procedures and precedent of the U.S. Senate when it comes to something called the blue slip. It's very important that only the best and the brightest get confirmed to serve in these very important positions. And I believe that Ms. Saldana is the best qualified lawyer of the people that were reviewed by the evaluation committee and the people who I have personally interviewed to serve as a United States attorney in the Northern District of Texas. It's ironic that she's not exactly a rock-ribbed Republican. She's a proud Democrat. She's a career prosecutor, as you know, who has not shied away from controversial or tough cases, and who clearly understands that no one is above the law. I think the White House would set a very bad precedent if they bowed to political pressure rather than to back this outstanding nominee for United States Attorney. And I've urged the President, as has Senator Hutchison, to continue supporting her nomination in unequivocal terms. If he does, then he will have my support, as will Ms. Saldana. Well, clearly I've talked enough for one afternoon and perhaps have made enough news for one day to I'll stop there. And if it's appropriate, I'll be glad to answer a few questions. Thank you very much.
We do have time for some questions. Would anyone like to ask one? Dan?
Yeah. Senator Gordon, two quick questions. Guantanamo, as well as possible prosecution of Bush administration officials, particularly those in the Justice Department, racial movement, matters that Obama administration is not taking. What's the status of both of those?
Well, you know, we've heard different things at different times. The different times the President said we need to look forward, not backward. And, of course, you can imagine what the threat of an investigation and prosecution has done to the lives of those people who thought that they were doing nothing more and nothing less than their duty to protect the American people and to operate within the constraints of what they understood the law to be. And it would be enormously destructive, I think, of our ability to do much else in Washington, D.C., to go back and to second-guess decisions that were made right after 9/11 at a time when we did not know whether there would be follow-on attacks in this country. And I think there has to be some closure, and the closure, I think, needs to come through a process that's not subject of intimidation, or that people aren't risk averse in terms of what they do when they are either interpreting what the law is or relying upon those legal judgments in doing renditions, enhanced interrogations, and the like, that the threat that they may come back and lose everything they've worked a lifetime to achieve because someone has trying to now second guess it after the fact. So I don't know what the Attorney General is going to do. He has said different things at different times. The latest thing I've heard him say publicly is that he intended to pursue an investigation of Bush administration, Department of Justice employees. It's fraught with danger and something they ought to be very careful about. I just think it's a big mistake.
Is there anything the Judiciary Committee can do to come in opposite?
I would say, I would say the next move is theirs. I wouldn't say what we can and cannot do. I'm sure if they overreach and make what I consider to be a bad decision, there are things we might do, but I'm probably not going to talk about those in public right now.
I think we've got time for one more question. Anyone?
Yes, sir.
I think if I might, Senator Sessions and Senator Leahy have traded comments about whether the ACLU or the Federal Society is a bigger black mark.
Yeah, we had a conversation, I think it was yesterday, maybe the day before, about that, because one of the nominees was a federal magistrate judge in California that was confirmed. I think it's Judge Chin now, who was a longtime staff lawyer with the ACLU. And during the Bush administration, when many people who had long affiliations with the Federalist Society were nominated, it was as if this is a black stain on their otherwise impeccable reputation. So there was a little friendly jousting about whether the ACLU ought to be treated the same way. But in the end, I think we're going to look at the candidates individually and how, not just the associations they've had, but how they've conducted themselves and whether they embrace a notion of law as one that is something that is passed mainly by the elected representatives of the people and something that judges interpret, not an opportunity to exploit for political or ideological gain. Thank you very much.
Again, let me thank you all for coming and remind you that if you sign up, we will get you CLE credit. We'll also make sure that you're on our distribution list so you know about all of our future events. I should also mention in that vein that next month, the Federal Society will be having its national convention in Washington. If your schedules allow between the November 12th and November 14th, please do come. We would love to see you there. With that said, again, thank you all for coming, and thank you, Senator, very much. Absolutely.